Holding Court with Mike Trevelyan and Dean Sheridan. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Holding Court. Holding Court is the podcast where we discuss crimes, court cases, laws, things of that nature. I am Dean Sheridan, one of your hosts, and your other host is Michael Trevelyan. He is a trained barrister, at least I hope he trained, and they didn't just go, here you go, try it. And he will give us the more educational points, and I'll be the guy that sits there and goes, but what about that? Like that. So how are you, Mike?
I am very well, thank you. I am anticipating a very exciting day because not only have we got the podcast, which is normally the highlight of my week, it's also your birthday, so happy birthday to you. And then we are meeting up after the podcast, so that'll be good. We're watching some films, that's going to be great. And also, in between these two events, I am going for the first time to go and meet my little puppy. So it's just going to be a great day. It's going to be a great day.
9/11 is shaping up to be a great day.
Yeah, I think it will be forever remembered as just one of the best dates in the calendar.
Yes, just due to this. Yes. It's always been quite a strange day to have a birthday. Well, since 2001 it has. Before that, it was just a normal day. But because I could always tell. I was like, oh, it's definitely coming up to my birthday because Netflix and everything are filled with documentaries about 9/11.
Yeah, that must be slightly weird. That must be slightly weird. I mean, what's your sort of memory of 9/11? You know, where were you when it happened?
Well, it was my 11th birthday. Mm-hmm. I was at school. And then I came back, and I think they turned off all the TVs and that. I didn't notice. We had just a few people over, had some food, got my presents. I was a bit oblivious. You know, when you're 11, you don't really know that. Well, I knew enough, but sometimes the TV, everything seems so far away that, you know, at that stage, I don't think you can fully grasp the level of what happens when the Twin Towers fall down in the middle of a major Western city. You know, because you see shit on the news all the time. So to me, it was just another crazy news story that was on TV. But because I couldn't quite conceptualize that, you know, it was in New York, which I guess is kind of a bad thing. It's like, yeah, if it was anywhere else and something just blew up, I'd just be fine. But but I can imagine it must have been quite terrifying for anyone watching. If something like that happened today, that would be...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but you didn't really grasp it. I didn't really grasp what had gone on till the next day when it was then on the TV and I was seeing it. I didn't fully understand. But on the actual day of the birthday of the actual event, I think I was pretty oblivious to what was going on.
Good, good. Well, I think that's right, isn't it, if it's your birthday and you're an 11-year-old. I don't think you need to necessarily concern yourself with geopolitics on that specific day.
Although I think I'm going to watch this film that's just come out and we should discuss it next week. Which is called Worth, and it's got Michael Keaton in. I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen the trailer and that. It's on Netflix. I don't know if it's any good, but I'll give it a watch. But it's Michael Keaton plays a lawyer who has to pay out to the families from the 9/11, from what happened in 9/11 when the government said that they would pay families some compensation or whatever you'd name that.
Yeah, there because was a it's fund, not technically, wasn't there, I think.
Yeah, it's not technically compensation, and he had to basically create what people were worth by the jobs and things that they had, how much money you got paid, and it was his job to divvy that up. And the whole film is about the sort of moral sort of cold calculation and how that works. Got a good cast, Michael Keaton, Stanley Tucci, he's a good actor. It looks like it'll be a good film. I'd like to know how close to the real story it is, but it's based on a book, supposedly, which would be, I think, an autobiography. It was written by the lawyer. So that could be worth a discussion next week. So there's
a prelim. Absolutely. Yes. Perhaps we should try and watch it together as a sort of Holding Court research trip. Ooh. And then we can then discuss it in the following week's podcast. Look at that.
It could be a movie review / case.
Yes, we can be the new Commode and Mayo.
yes. That's my favourite kind of sandwich. So I will move on to our first case of the day. And this is man fined for having a World War II tank in his basement. Right, so this was, I think it started in 2015, but the article is from this year, so I'm guessing it's come to the end of it. And he was a German pensioner who's 84 years old. He's been handed a suspended prison sentence of 14 months and has been ordered to pay a fine of €250,000, so £213,469. Let's put that in brackets for me. I didn't work that out. officials found the tank and other World War II era military equipment at the defendant's house in the northern town of Heikendorf in 2015. The army had to help remove the items. On Monday, so this is in August this year, the court ordered that the defendant, who cannot be named under German privacy laws, must sell or donate the tank and an anti-aircraft cannon to a museum or collective in the next 2 years. According to the defendant's lawyer, a US museum is interested in purchasing the Panther tank because it was one of Germany's major tanks. The lawyer also said that a number of German collectors have approached the defendant over other items, which included assault rifles and pistols. I mean, why are these German collectors, unless it's a museum, I'm guessing it must be, why are they able to approach to buy these items off him, but he couldn't store them himself?
Well, I know a little bit about this, because there is a part of the German criminal code. So because Germany, like France and a lot of continental countries, they have a completely different legal system to us. So they tend to have everything in a kind of statutory form. They don't so much have a sort of development of the common law through decided cases. So part of the German criminal code regulates the possession and use of items and paraphernalia related to what's referred to as unconstitutional organizations. So things like National Socialist, so Nazi Party stuff with, you know, swastikas or whatever, is really, really closely regulated. And one of the restrictions in the German criminal code, which may be relevant here, is that I think you're not allowed to own in Germany anything that has symbols of unconstitutional organizations, which I assume these tanks and anti-aircraft weapons probably would have, unless it's in the context of art, science, research, or teaching. And you're also not allowed to stock those items domestically. So I suspect that's probably why a museum would be fine to have it, whereas a domestic individual wouldn't, because I suppose the museum would be caught by the, you know, research or teaching exemption. I may be completely wrong about that. It may be that there's specific laws saying you can't own tanks in basements, but I do happen to know that German law very strictly regulates who can have and display and possess anything that's got symbology of so-called unconstitutional organizations on it.
I mean, I guess it doesn't state whether this tank is live, as in whether, you know, the...
I don't think any tanks have become self-aware yet.
Yes,
it could be coming.
Sort of Transformer vibe tank.
Yes, yeah. It's actually locked in the basement. That's what you're trying to get out.
Yes, Mecha Führer. yeah, no, but what I mean is, like, is it like, you know, is the cannon on it? I mean, I don't know the technical name for that is. Is it just a cannon? What's on the front of it?
I think so, yeah. Turret, gun, if you will.
Yes, well, I think everyone gets what we're talking about. The sort of Dalek-y part of a tank.
Yes, if you imagine, dear listener, if you imagine a normal car and then you just attach a long piece of drain pipe to the top of it, that drain pipe bit is what we're talking about. You've got us now. Come on, we're painting a picture here. We really are wordsmiths on this podcast.
I know, yeah. If no one's ever heard or seen a tank before, they now know.
Absolutely.
But it actually says here that the local authorities raided the property in 2015 after receiving a tip-off about the building's contents by colleagues in Berlin who had earlier searched a home for stolen Nazi art. So I think that's how they discovered it. So I don't, obviously the name is private, so I don't know, he's 84 years old, whether he was an ex-soldier. Let's try and think, 84 in, what, where are we in 2021? I can't be asked to do the math. 55, 65, 70.
I mean, he'd certainly fall into...
No, he would be like a little kid. He would have been like about five or six, wouldn't he?
Well, he'd have been born in 1937. So, yeah, he'd have been too young to certainly to drive the tank, one would assume.
It's all right. Geez, it's mad to think that actually it's that long ago now. I mean, I wasn't there. I'm saying that like only yesterday. just when you put into the fact that an 84-year-old couldn't possibly have even been in the war.
Yeah,
it's a strange concept. Surprising. Yeah. So yeah, it took 20 soldiers almost 9 hours to extract the Panther tank. But this is the weird thing. Local media reported that the man had been seen one winter using the tank as a snowplow.
Well, good on him. You know, you've got to put these things to good use.
I mean, yeah, if you're trying to hide it. But this is where I can't think of the logistics. So it took 20 soldiers almost 9 hours to extract the Panther from his basement, right? So they said there were no tracks on it when they found it anyway. But previously he'd been using it as a snowplow. How the hell did he get that tank down into his basement? I mean, obviously, I've probably got a warped idea of exactly what his basement is, basing it on, you know, a regular basement that I see, which is like a door that leads down, a sort of when we play Phasmophobia type of basement, where you just open a single door and walk down some steps into the basement, the kind of door that you couldn't imagine getting a whole tank down.
No, I mean, I'm with you, because the only sort of means of ingress to a basement I've ever seen are, like you say, steps inside a house, or you'd have like a coal chute, wouldn't you, outside. But not big enough to put a tank down, I wouldn't have thought.
Just roll it down the coal chute.
I mean, unless he was some sort of, you know, Meccano enthusiast, and he was able to sort of break it down into parts, move that into the basement, and then reconstruct it.
Either that, or he's some sort of like German super soldier, and he just sort of like, you know, walked to the front and just slowly lowered it down. it's why he can't be named.
He's actually part of a secret government program.
Captain Germany.
I mean, I suspect that it's certainly possible, but I suspect if that were the story, that might be more in the headline than the fact he had the tank. I think the fact that it's a super, super secret German soldier program might be more the tale.
Maybe they're just trying to not cause mass panic by having the article, a super soldier keeps arsenal in basement.
That is true, actually. I think if I was the editor of that particular newspaper, I would probably be urging caution at this stage.
Yeah.
We don't want to annoy the super soldier.
But
that's
yes,
very important.
That's a little mystery there. See if any of our listeners can find out how you get a tank down into a basement. Or if there's any German listeners, maybe there's like a form of architecture in some German houses. I'm guessing he has quite a bit of land, so I'm assuming it's land. And he's not just like, you know, when they saw him snow plowing in the tank, it was just on his front drive. So I'm assuming that maybe there is a way into a basement that is more than just a sort of, I mean, I'm going off the sort of American farmland idea, sort of two wooden doors that you open up and go down into a sort of a Dorothy from the Wizard of Oz hiding from the hurricane style thing.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking maybe it is a feature of a certain era of German home building that just as a matter of course just incorporates a tank chute directly into the basement. And it's a bit like, you know, in certain parts of France, you have those wooden shutters over the windows where it gets hot, and that's just the way they build houses. Perhaps it's just the same in certain parts of Germany. They just always have a little tank means of ingress.
Could have been like their version of a sort of dad's army, you know, like a home. And, you know, like they just basically, everyone had kept a little tank underneath the house. So, that, you know, if there was ever an invasion, or they could just pop out from below the ground in tanks. I mean, how terrifying would that be? You're making your way into Germany and all these tanks just start popping up out the ground.
Popping up like moles.
Yeah, I know.
I'm also intrigued by the anti-aircraft gun, which I don't think has had the billing in this story that it should have done. Because, I mean, at least a tank, you know, is designed to move. Whereas an anti-aircraft gun is intended, I think, to be a fairly stationary object, isn't it? So
I think it has like wheels underneath it, because they would wheel them out into like the fields and stuff like that. I mean, it's a big thing.
Are you casting your mind back to when you were in World War II?
No. See, I've seen plenty of World War II documentaries. And whenever you see the sort of anti-aircraft gun, and the one I'm sort of thinking of is like a much fancier version of just a cannon that they would have out, and it would just like, they'd just like drop it in, it would just like, poof, and just, you know, shoot up into the air.
Oh, actually, yeah, I do.
It always seemed to have some sort of tracks or something, like a minecart kind of thing. So they'd be able to pull it, they'd be able to take it. They'd usually travel, put it on something to travel long distances, and then they could pull it out and take it into a certain area to set it up to be firing. It wasn't like built in.
No, you're quite right. I was quite wrong about that. You have rightly corrected me. Thank you.
That's all right. So welcome to the History Hour with Holding Court. I mean, I'm just taking guesses off what I've seen. I'm just assuming there's no picture of this anti-aircraft gun. So maybe it is that massive like Uber tank that Hitler built near the end, that big, huge super gun.
Well, I mean, it's certainly possible, isn't it? I think there's a lot more going on with this story than we will ever know.
This is something I want to keep an eye on. I want to know the history of it. It's all very vague. It's just man with tank and loads of guns, and just not enough on how. You know, you must have had someone helping him. Someone knew he had that tank. I mean, apart from the people who saw him, you know, snow plowing.
Yeah, I can imagine when the snow comes down and the neighbours are like, I'll tell you what, if you do my drive as well, I'll keep quiet about the tank.
And they just send him like really funny little messages saying, thanks for helping me with my garden.
Thanks for the ploughing.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. It's also worth just saying, just on a sort of legal point, that connected to this idea of owning and possessing items of a restricted nature in Germany. Germany also has very strict laws regulating the depiction of anything to do with war and violence. And as a consequence of that, in video games like Wolfenstein, which is set in a kind of alternate future history where Germany won the Second World War. And in the UK version of that game, there's lots of Nazi sort of iconography. The Germans have their own version of the game, which removes all of that. And in all, I think all German video games, they are not allowed to depict blood. So all of the blood that would appear in a video game is modded in Germany so that it comes out green rather than red, in order to avoid the censorship laws in Germany, which are still quite strict as a consequence primarily of World War II.
I mean, I'm not trying to be mean or anything, but why even bother releasing Wolfenstein in Germany? I mean, only because Wolfenstein is literally about what alternate reality where if the Nazis won the war, what it would be like. And I've heard of this, and I've seen the video side by side with the German version of a scene that had Hitler in and the English version. And I've played the game as well. I've got both the new ones anyway. And yeah, they like remove his mustache and make him look slightly differently. And I think instead of like Nazi memorabilia, they've got a different sort of symbol. They're like a new form of like world order that isn't Nazis. But I just wonder how, I'd like to play the whole game, see how they sort of bypass certain things. Because at the start of it, it's set sort of as World War II. So there's a whole mythos that comes with that that must be completely shifted. Or either that, or they've just covered it enough, but everyone playing it is like, well, these are obviously the Nazis because everything else is the same.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a problem in Germany that because the rules on displaying sort of prohibited symbols are quite prescriptive. So it's effectively, you know, you cannot display these kind of symbols in a big list. So one of the problems that they have in Germany with the new far right is that they will, as you say, slightly modify known symbols so that it falls outside of the ban. But it's obvious to everyone what that symbol is supposed to depict. And I think this is a sort of, it's a less troubling version of that in the context of the video game, but it is a problem in Germany with these sorts of symbols, yeah.
Well, don't hold me to it, but I've believe that I saw an article not long ago where Germany is actually now allowing it in sort of video games and stuff. Maybe I'm just talking out my ass, but I knew about the ban and that they wouldn't have, you know, images of Hitler or stuff, and he couldn't be in like video games. So yeah, Wolfenstein had to change, but I believe that something has, that they may have relaxed it slightly now.
Fair enough. I'm not 100%.
Maybe I have to revisit this and look it up. But I just remember seeing an article. Something at the back of my mind says that very recently, or in the last year or so, they've allowed it. I don't know if they've retconned anything previously, but whether they will allow certain things anyway. I have to look it up. There's probably some caveats to it. It's probably not as straightforward as now anything goes, but you know.
No, well, hopefully not.
No, I don't just mean, like, you know, like, yeah, no, everybody just get back to how we were in the 40s. I mean, like, as in a caveat, as in, you know, maybe they can't just stick every game or do everything that we do here, but, like, there might be
certain things
it would allow. So it depends. Obviously, I'm guessing World at War wasn't a big seller in Germany. Was that even allowed to be sold in Germany?
I don't know. I would have thought a modified version would be capable of being sold. Yeah.
But is that not modifying history?
Well, there is a question about that, isn't there?
I mean, I understand Wolfenstein because it's a false creation of what would happen, and it works in the same way if you choose some other sort of global superpower as the enemy. But if you're literally doing a game called World at War, or I guess in films would be similar, something like Saving Private Ryan or something like that, whether that was even released in Germany, I'm not quite sure. Then if you are editing that, then maybe you edit it to get rid of symbolism, but keep the concept. I could understand that, you know, like no flags and things like that. Apart from that, it does get to a point where if you're making, say you're playing World at War and they're making it seem like some of the enemies that you're fighting are some completely new made up army, it isn't that editing history.
Well, yes, it is, isn't it? And I suppose there's always a balance to be struck between displaying things as they were for the sake of historical accuracy and glorifying or in any other way promoting something which you don't want to promote. I suppose it is quite a difficult balancing act. But I take your point entirely. That, you know, there's certainly an argument to say that if you're depicting something historical, then it should be a warts and all depiction.
I mean, Age of Empires let me play as William Wallace and chop up some Brits.
Well, there is that. There is that. And, you know, when I used to play Theme Park, I was allowed to put as much salt in the fries as I wanted to, which depicts the true horrors of capitalism, because then people drink more Coca-Cola.
Ah, you know what? I never did that. I never got that much into the economics. I just used to build giant roller coasters.
Well, that's what you've got to do. So you've got to squeeze every drop out of these customers. Get as much money as you can for more roller coasters.
Welcome to the capitalism hour. Right. I'll move on to our next case now, which is a slightly controversial one, I guess. Shemima Begum, right? And I thought this might be something you'd know a great deal about. It's not a straightforward sort of immigration case, is it? Well, she's not technically an immigrant. But I thought this was all sort of over with a few years ago when it was all in the media and memes and all sorts of making their way around the internet. But it turns out it's still going on, and the last sort of update I got was from February of this year. So if anyone is unaware of this, I'm sure a lot of people in the UK would be aware of this, but those abroad might not be. Shemima Begum was a young girl, I think she was 15 years old, a young Muslim girl who travelled via Turkey to the ISIS headquarters in Raqqa, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, where she married a Dutch recruit, so another IS soldier, who was the father of her children. And then she was there for a few years, and she lost two of her children, was pregnant with a third when she was in a camp in 2019. But the child that she had there also died, and basically she wanted to return to England, having been an ISIS bride for, say, the last 4 years. So there was quite a bit of controversy, a lot of split thoughts, I would say, throughout the UK, of some people who believe she deserved to come back, mainly because I think of the age she was at the time, being one of the major factors that she was 15 when she went. And I think she went with two of her friends. One of them has been confirmed to have been killed. One of them, they're not quite sure where she is, but they sort of think it's likely there's a similar fate. There was a lot of arguments about it, but they ended up cancelling her British citizenship and not allowing her to come home. And supposedly she could appeal against it, but they wouldn't allow her to return to the UK to appeal against it, because it would be seen as putting the country at risk to allow her back into the UK. So although she can appeal, she can't appeal here. She can't come here to the court, which is, I believe, the last thing she was after. And that was eventually turned down as well. So they've sort of paused her current situation, and they're trying to find a way to work around it, because they believe that doing it from Syria, I'm not exactly sure why, but it's not that she needs to go somewhere else to a proper court system and not do it from the camp in Syria. But yeah, she's recently been refused again. But technically, they're saying it's a bit of an odd one, because obviously it's a little bit, she's sort of created the bad situation for herself, where she's allowed to appeal, but at the same time, she has no British citizenship. And because it's a weird sort of legal dominion, because technically, if she's been refused citizenship due to her terrorist links or previous terrorist links, it makes her a threat to the country. So they can't let her in to stand, well, not stand trial, but to appeal. And at the same time, she also has the right to appeal.
Yes. The Shamima Begum case is really interesting for a number of reasons, and it's the sort of thing that, you know, we could talk about for ages and ages. So I will try and sort of give a brief overview of some of the key issues, but it's a lot more detailed and a lot more complicated than I'm going to give it credit for. So one of the interesting things is that this decision has to be seen, in my view, against the backdrop of a previous government policy that was dealt with back in 2017 by the Supreme Court in two linked cases called Chiari and Bindloss. And the reason why these two cases are relevant is because the government adopted a policy under the Nationality, Immigration and Asylum Act, I think, of 2002, that in certain cases where they were going to reject someone's appeal, reject somebody's objection to being deported. So the Home Secretary wanted to deport someone, they could oppose that deportation. But what the Home Secretary could then do is say, we're still going to deport you from the country, and we are going to certify your case under the Nationality, Immigration and Asylum Act so that you have a right of appeal, because you must have a right of appeal against a deportation. But the effect of the certification is that we can deport you first and then you can appeal later. So we're going to send you back to wherever it is you say you can't go because it's not safe. And then if you can, and if you want to, you can appeal effectively by video link back to the courts here in the UK, but we'll get rid of you first. And then we'll deal with the question of whether it was right to get rid of you later. For obvious reasons, that was quite controversial, because most deportation appeals are on the basis that somebody can't go back to the country they're being deported to because their life will be in danger. So the Supreme Court dealt with this in Chiari and Bindloss, and they effectively said, deport first, appeal later is unlawful, because it puts it damages the individual's right to a fair trial by expecting them to appeal from abroad by video. There are just too many ways in which that's not going to be practical. Now, the reason why that case or those two linked cases are relevant to Shamima Begum is that effectively what is happening in Shamima Begum's case is the court are saying, well, she can have an appeal, but it can be carried on from abroad. So a bit like the deportation appeals. But then you get into this tension between national security on the one hand, which says, you know, she shouldn't be allowed to come into the UK, and the right to a fair trial on the other. And following Chiari and Bindlos, you might well think that the court would say, well, we can't expect Shamima Begum to appeal from abroad because we've already decided in the context of deportation that that is an unlawful infringement on her right to a fair trial. But in Shamima Begum's case, because there were national security concerns, the view was taken that the Home Secretary's decision should not be impugned by the courts for two reasons. The Home Secretary is said to have potentially secret information to which the court is not privy, which might justify the decision. And therefore, you have to give a margin of leeway to the Home Secretary in making her decision, or his decision at the time, because it was Sajid Javid. But you also have the ability, as the electorate, to get rid of your Home Secretary in an election. And the view that the court took was that that is the safeguard that would operate to prevent the Home Secretary acting arbitrarily. Now, that to me seems entirely artificial, the idea that, you know, in Shamima Begum's case, if the Home Secretary has wrongly prevented her from entering the country, that the electorate is going to rise up at the next election and say, we're not going to vote Tory because of the Shamima Begum case. I don't think that's necessarily very practical. But the important point is that in balancing the national security interests, which say that Shamima Begum shouldn't come into the country, against the right to a fair trial, which says that she should come into the country, because following Chiari and Bindlos, it's difficult to have a fair trial by video link. What the Supreme Court have essentially done is they've recognised that she can't have a fair trial, but they've said that that's not as important as the national security concerns. Now, there is a very hackneyed phrase that all lawyers are familiar with, which is justice delayed is justice denied. And what the Supreme Court have said is that the Begum appeal needs to be put on ice until a mechanism can be found for her to give evidence in a way which is fair and safe. But how is that to be done? Nobody really knows. So what you have is a situation where the court have effectively recognised you're not going to be able to have a fair trial, but that's fine. We're willing to accept that in the light of national security concerns. But we are going to stop you from having to have a trial because it would be unfair. So we're going to delay your case indefinitely, even though justice delayed is justice denied. So it's incredibly difficult, I think, to square that circle and to say that this is an outcome that is, in an individual case, justifiable. To what extent?
So are you saying that basically they'll just keep it indefinitely in limbo, like forever, and there'll never be anything that happens next because you can't appeal?
Well, this is the problem. So, something's going to have to be done about this. So in some way, she's going to have to be able to take an effective part in the proceedings. In the judgment, the court actually said that the conclusion they had come to was not a perfect solution. And they acknowledged it's not known how long it may be before that is possible, that being Ms. Begum taking an effective part in the proceedings. So what we have is a circumstance where, as you say, I mean, it may be indefinite. And this woman may well have a situation where, I don't know, she might ultimately be vindicated if she can get her case determined. And this is why that principle of justice delayed is justice denied is quite important and well established. Because, of course, in the meantime, she's stuck presumably in a refugee camp in fairly appalling conditions. And it's one thing if you can say, well, look, you know, we have a robust, independent judicial process and you've been through that process and we've decided applying the law that you shouldn't come to the UK and live here. That's one thing. But what's happening to her is that they're saying, well, we don't know. You may very well have a legitimate reason and a legal entitlement to come here. But of course, until the case is determined, you have to stay where you are, which feels very much like she's lost her case before it's been decided, because the outcome is effectively the same, isn't it? She's still stuck in the same place.
So the appeal is to appeal her loss of citizenship. So her loss of citizenship isn't something that could be used as a, well, you're not a citizen, so what do you get, you know, a fair trial?
Well, this is exactly the thing, isn't it? Because you end up in a slightly chicken and egg situation, because she's saying, well, you shouldn't have revoked my citizenship, and therefore I should have all the rights of a citizen. It's worth saying, of course, that in our system, we don't discriminate between citizens and non-citizens anyway. So if you are a British citizen and you come to court, you should be treated the same as a non-British national who perhaps is here on a, you know, temporary visa or something like that. So the issue with the citizenship isn't so much the access to a right to a fair trial, but it's her ability to come to the UK. Because if you get out your passport, you will see that if you have a British passport, it will say on it that the holder of the passport is to be given all assistance to enter the UK without let or hindrance. And the idea is that you can come into the UK as a British citizen. That's the theory. Of course, there are restrictions anyway on that. But that's the important point. If she's a citizen, then she's pretty much allowed to come back here.
Okay. So do you have any personal opinions on the case?
Well, I mean, it is a difficult balancing act. I struggle a little bit, given how much publicity there's been given to the Begum case. I don't quite understand in this particular case why it would be so hard to set up an effective video link system. Because even if you have to say, look, you know, we're going to take you out of the refugee camp and we're going to arrange for you to be somewhere else with a stable internet connection where you can talk to your lawyers every day by video link and then we'll have the hearing. I'm not sure it's as difficult as people are making it out to be, but I don't know. And I think I have to take that at face value, that it is going to be very difficult for her to play an effective part in proceedings. And certainly in cases which would have attracted less publicity, perhaps it would be harder to do something.
Well, I looked up on, when I was looking this up online, and it gave you a sort of some stats. And it does seem that quite a few people that went over to IS or went to fight with them or left from England have actually come back into the UK by some means. Some of them, they say UK citizens, because technically the numbers are a little bit fudged, because they're also based on people who were born into areas of Iraq and IS control between 2013 and 2018. So these could also be children that are returning. And it's got as of July 2019, I think we've had about 450 people return, then France just below us, and Germany below us, and Sweden, Belgium, and the Netherlands have had about 50 odd. So these are happening, and it does seem that this Shamima Begum case seems to take, because it has, like you say, this massive media attention around it. Why is there a massive media attention around this one case in comparison to any of these other 400 odd cases?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's always difficult, isn't it, with anything like this, where sort of one example of many is picked to particularly determine why it's that one example. So to take a completely different context, you know, why is the Madeleine McCann kidnapping such a media issue when children are kidnapped frequently and don't get 1/100th of the publicity that that case does?
Or money.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there may be different reasons, but the point is, you know, you sometimes have this sort of exemplar of a wider problem, and it's used as a lens through which to analyze an issue affecting more than that one person. But I think Shamima Begum in particular was something that caught the public imagination because she was so young, and because what she was alleged to have done was so horrific. I think it was easy to see, putting the legalities to one side, it was easy for people to engage in on almost a kind of visceral level, because you had some people saying, well, she's a child and therefore, you know, she should be given leeway. And you had other people saying, yes, but she's done allegedly horrendous things. And there are certain situations in which you know, you cross the Rubicon and you can't then be indulged. So I think that's possibly why it fired the public imagination in that way when there were other similar cases.
I would say it was definitely a kind of trial by media, that whole thing. And it does seem that sometimes that what they're doing at the minute is also backed by the fact that it's such a big case. The sort of backlash, I think, if they were to turn around, would be pretty big. General reactions that you see from a lot of people is they don't feel that you could join a terrorist organization, technically be a terrorist, be involved in those kind of things, and then come back in. Would it be even be safer even if she did is another question. But then again, could it be any less safe than where she is? But yeah, I just think that, you know, it's been such a big thing. She's so famous across the UK, at least, that it's almost, like I say, a bit of a trial by media and the sort of, you know, sticking to their guns, and that is a kind of maybe more of like a vote getter than I would say for a lot of people tend to be on the side of that, you know, she shouldn't be able to come back, and therefore they sort of stick by it, yet are under the radar, people do come back. So it just feels like they use this sort of one case as their sort of example of setting an example and gaining sort of people's attention and trust.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're quite right to raise that this is as a political issue as much as it is a legal issue. And I think you're absolutely right to suggest that this is a case in which the government felt that it could win fairly substantial political points with enough of the electorate, because in a sense, it's a win-win for the government. Because for certainly the last decade and probably the last 20 or 30 years, successive governments have wanted to appear tough on immigration. And the line has effectively always been, we as the government are tough on immigration and we're tough on people coming into the country and we're tough on crime, but third parties are making it impossible for us to do that, whether it's the European Union, lefty lawyers, judges in the Supreme Court who are unelected and out of touch, you know. So the government always has that narrative of being able to say, you know, we are trying to be really tough, but we're just being frustrated at every turn by people who don't understand the concerns of the ordinary person in the country. And Shamima Begum is a great political tool if you're cynical, because what you do is you take her case and you use it to appear tough on immigration by refusing, you know, stripping her of citizenship and saying, look how tough we're being. And then either the courts turn around in the end and say you were right to do that, in which case it's a big win for the government, or the courts turn around and say you were wrong to do that and we're reversing your decision, in which case the government can keep that narrative going of saying, well, you know, we're trying our best to be tough, and then the judges are frustrating us and it's not our fault.
So in a way this could almost work against them, in the fact that they were like, yeah, we're still not doing it, and they've gone, okay, yeah, we're going to back you up. And then people can start to question, why aren't you being this tough on other situations of a similar ilk? And then they can't really turn around and go, yeah, well, you know, the Supreme Court.
Well, I mean, there is that, but I think part of it is because the Begum case is so extreme in terms of, you know, the fact she went off, allegedly joined a terrorist organization and committed crimes abroad. I think it would be relatively easy for the government to say, well, yes, that was in a particular class of particularly high-level national security, whereas your average, you know, immigrant coming in that, you know, the Daily Mail wants to kick out is in a slightly different category. So I think it will be possible for the government to push a narrative distinguishing between people like Shamima Begum and people who are just general immigrants. But you're right. I mean, it's got the potential to backfire. Yeah. But I think the calculation politically is that this is much more likely to be a vote winner than a vote loser.
Well, there you go. We'll leave Shamima Begum there. Not
just like the Supreme Court.
Yeah, no, yeah. Actually, I just realized what I said. Well, So we'll move on to the next part of the show. This is the I Call Bullshit section of the show. And it's taken quite a turn from the sort of political side of things, but not too much. There's still some sort of political, because this is a law. This is, well, it could be a law, it might not be a law. I'll let you decide. This is definitely sent around in meme format. Let me just explain I Call Bullshit, which I've forgotten to do. I Call Bullshit is the part of the show where I present Mike with a law or a crime or a court case that seems crazy, and he has to let me know if he believes that it's false or true. And this part of the show usually comes from when people share memes or articles online that turn out to be rubbish, sort of fake news, or to get people, you know, to believe it, and it gets shared millions of times. Or sometimes it is just cases that are as crazy as they sound. So this is a law that appeared in a meme. It says that I'll do the meme sort of language so that you can get where it sort of stands in context. It's illegal to own more than 6 dildos in Texas, but you can own as many guns as you want.
Now, Texas, I understand, particularly at the moment, is having some real problems with sexuality, women's rights, and that kind of thing, and has always been a big fan of guns. So I think this is probably true, as weird as it sounds. I think they're going to be two completely separate laws that lead to this bizarre conclusion.
Yes, it is true. It's a real law. You can't own more than 6 dildos in Texas. And yeah, they are obviously completely different laws. It was just obviously meme being a meme. It was pulling the comparison that you could own as many guns as you want, but you couldn't stick as many things inside of you as you would like. so yes, it says that section 43.23, obscenity, of the Texas Penal Code considers a felon a person commits an offense if, knowing its content and character, he wholesale promotes or possesses with intent to wholesale promote any obscene material or obscene device. And then under provision F, a person who possesses 6 or more obscene devices or identical or similar obscene articles is presumed to possess them with intent to promote the same. So it kind of feels like when people get pulled over and they've got like a little bag of weed, right? And they're like, oh, well, that's obviously for personal use, and you don't get into as much trouble. But if you get pulled over and you've got this huge, like, you know, kilo, ounce of weed, then they're a bit like, wow, that's not just for you, is it? So it feels like if they come and they find you one dildo in the boot, they might be like, oh, it's for personal use. They open it, it's a whole suitcase full of dildos. They're like, oh, he's willing to sell. He's like going to go to like a dark alley and people just turn up to buy their dildos off him. So I assume with this law that you can't have an adult sex shop.
No, I presume not.
I mean, I say adult sex shop like there's any other, but you understand what I mean, adult shop.
Yeah, I presume not. I mean, I, you're absolutely right. I was going to draw exactly the same parallel between possession of drugs for personal use and possession of drugs with intent to supply. And that seems to be a useful parallel to draw. Yeah, I suppose that would be illegal. Whether it's possible to get specific licenses or something like that, so that if you were a sort of recognized sex, because presumably people, I mean, well, I suppose you look at drugs again, don't you? But I was going to say, presumably people have to have a way of buying one dildo.
Yeah, but could like Amazon be a certain thing? I mean, it's a retailer that's set outside of the state. You know,
well, yes,
they purchase from outside the state, it gets delivered, they get their one dildo, and then they slowly build up their collection. But then if you pull over the Amazon driver and he's got a truck full of dildos.
yeah, it strikes me as possibly something that's more honoured in the breach than in the observance, this law. But I think it does create a potential minefield of difficulty, as you say, with out-of-state purchases and whatever. I'm not sure how that would work.
And says the Texas Penal Code understands that an obscene device means a device including a dildo or artificial designer, designed or marketed as useful primarily for the stimulation of human genital organs. So, Crystal Orr considers dildos obscene devices, and a person who owns more than 6 obscene devices is committing a criminal offence. Therefore, owning 6 dildos, in brackets, or plastic vaginas, is illegal. The regulation is a complete violation of the 14th Amendment. Engage in private intimate conduct in the home without government intrusion. Judges on the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals found the law unconstitutional in a ruling from 2008, considering that the Texas statute cannot define sexual devices themselves as obscene and prohibit their sale. However, with a GOP majority in the House and in the Senate, the law remains in the books. So yes, under Texas law, it is not allowed for a person to own 6 dildos, but she can own 6 or more different guns. It says Mississippi, Alabama, and Virginia have similar laws. So for Republicans, it is an outrage that a person can't own as many guns as he wants, but it's completely normal to ban owning more than 6 dildos. It's a weird law. I think you should have as many guns and dildos as you want.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, you'd have a gun that shoots dildos.
Exactly. It'd be perfect. I mean, would that not just be the ultimate party? I mean, if I thought ahead, tonight could have been a guns and dildos night, and I could have had everyone over for a drink.
And then before, see, this is, dear listener, how good Dean is at picking his topics for discussion, because haven't we now come back full circle to our first story of the man with the anti-tank gun? What do you put in there? You don't put bullets.
Giant dildos.
You put massive dildos and you just fire them out.
Yeah. But don't.
And that is a great note.
Don't put any Nazi symbolism on the dildos.
No.
Otherwise it could be taken from you. Don't know where it would be hidden, but they've just got like this little evidence case full of Nazi dildos. But but yeah, so it says here that there. So I looked up, then I went onto the Wikipedia page. So please take some of these maybe with a pinch of salt, just to have a look at the actual sort of law, the obscenity. What is it? Texas obscenity statute. So it says prosecuted cases, because I just wanted an idea if it's ever been used, or because it doesn't seem to be, although it is a law, it does seem to be one that is often glazed over and doesn't always get used, as in like, because it is a little bit ridiculous. I don't think they're as hard upon it.
As it were,
yes. So prosecution under the statute is rare, but it's occasionally occurred. So I think it says in 2001, attorneys Mary and Ted Roberts used the obscenity statute in an elaborate extortion scheme against some men who had sex with Mary Roberts. In Burleson in 2004, Joan Webb, a mother of 3 and former school teacher, faced up to 1 year in prison for selling a vibrator to 2 undercover police officers, posing as a married couple at a private party, but she was later acquitted and the undercover officers were issued reprimands. Oh, okay, that's weird. In 2007, a lingerie shop in Lubbock was raided and items deemed to be illegal by the Texas Penal Code were confiscated. The clerk on duty at the time was arrested and may have to register as a sex offender. So they haven't put much information into that, as in it says deemed to be illegal by the Texas Penal Code. They don't specify lots of dildos. God knows what she was selling. But if it was lots of dildos, then that's a little bit harsh. It just sounds like an Ann Summers to me. And registered as a sex offender is pretty harsh. But then again, like I say, you don't know the full story. I looked up the Mary and Ted Roberts one just to get an idea. But this is a really weird one that doesn't seem to go with the sort of what I was talking about. This says that basically Ted Roberts and his wife Mary, both attorneys, were convicted in a sex scheme in which they squeezed over $150,000 from 4 San Antonio men. According to 2007 trial testimony, Mary Roberts would have intimate affairs with the men. Then the couple would threaten to sue them and expose the affairs unless they contributed to a charity of Roberts' choice. But there was no charity. Roberts just pocketed the money. So I don't know what that has to do with owning loads of dildos or anything like that. That sounds like they got into trouble for blackmailing people.
Yeah, it's not immediately clear to me how that's connected.
No, but they mentioned it in the Wikipedia. That's what I mean, take it with a pinch of salt. But yeah, so it doesn't seem to be used a great deal. It will probably only get used in, I would say, bigger cases where they're trying to add more to the issue and using it as an extra sort of break of the law. I would say if there's something bigger going on, and they were like, oh, and then also this statute was broken in what they were doing with all these dildos, also as a way, let's say if it was a big court case, in sort of working against the character of maybe someone who's on trial by raising this statute. But it doesn't seem to be on its own a particularly strong one to use.
No, I mean, there's a lot of laws in this country as well, which are, you know, technically on the statute book, but just aren't enforced. And this strikes me as a similar example from what I can tell from what you said.
Yes. I mean, if your wife had more than six dildos, so if any of our Texan listeners, if your wife has more than six dildos, just be a good husband. And if the police come snooping, say that half of them belong to you.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable.
Share the load.
Yes, precisely.
There you go.
Make the hard decision.
Yes. See, we've just solved the dildo crisis of Texas.
The great Texan dildo crisis of 2021.
In brackets and artificial vaginas. So, yes, I think that seems like a good place to end today's I Call Bullshit and holding court. Is there anything you have to say before we leave, Mike?
Yes, there is, actually. A friend of the show and guest on a previous episode, Olivia Appleby from My Chambers, is tomorrow, the 12th of September, running in the Brighton Marathon. With another colleague of mine in Chambers, Joshua Purser. Olivia is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a marathon runner. This will be her first marathon. I bumped into her yesterday at a sort of barrister party thing in Birmingham, and she told me that she had lost her running shoes 6 weeks ago and wasn't intending to replace them for the marathon, so was just going to run in sort of old trainers. She told me that her training has not gone tremendously well, and as was everybody else, including myself at this event, she was eating and drinking heartily despite having a marathon to run on the Sunday. So she expressed some concern about whether or not she would die on this marathon, because one of the great joys of Olivia is that she's a very dedicated individual. So she's not going to give up on this marathon. She will either run the marathon or she will die. But either way, she has been asking for sponsorship for the charity, the London Legal Support Trust. And I'm going to say this in the full knowledge that I'm not the one who has to do it, but we can put, I assume, a link to the sponsorship in the notes for the show. So if you're looking at this on your podcast provider, where we have the narrative of what this show is about, we'll put a link to Olivia's sponsorship page. And please do sponsor her, because it's going to be quite the thing to have her run this marathon. I've said all of that. Dean's looking at me as if his head is about to explode. So I'm not sure if we can put a link in to the show notes.
I'm just thinking that's what we're going to do. I've never done it. I'm happy to put the link in. But if not, then the link will definitely be on our Facebook. I will try and get it onto our actual description. I'm sure it can be done.
That's a good idea.
I'm sure it can be done, but there will definitely be a link on our Facebook as well. And by the way, if you don't follow us on Facebook, look up Holding Court with Dean and Mike, or Mike and Dean. I forget what way around it is. But we're on Facebook and you'll find us. It'll have the image of our podcast on there. Yes.
I should just add as well that if I didn't say this already, it's the Brighton Marathon that they are running. And I'm given to understand that one of the features of the Brighton Marathon is that there is a very, very big and very steep hill about a third of the way through the marathon. So it is a particularly difficult one. And apparently it's going to be about 20 degrees on Sunday. So it's going to be a real challenge. So please do dig deep and give of your money.
So I'm sure you'll know, because this will be released on the Monday, whether Olivia lived or not by the end. We'll also put that on the page.
Yes, we should try and get her back as a guest, possibly in ghost form.
Yes.
But to talk us through the charity and how the marathon went.
We will summon her to yes. speak to us. That was a Halloween special. There we go. See, we've got all these plans. The Halloween special is coming up, and it won't be far away. And in case you were worried, I've been told that after 100 podcasts, I too can go to one of these fancy barrister parties. So it's a...
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
That was more of a laugh. That will never happen. Anyway.
No, it's fine. You can be my plus one. It'll be great.
Okay. So thank you for tuning in to this week. And we hope you tune in again next week for another exciting episode of Holding Court.
Goodbye, everybody.
If you know of any strange court or legal cases you would like us to discuss on the show, feel free to email us at holding.court@outlook.com.